Hello, welcome to the Minnesota Alliance for Ethical Healthcare's first webinar of 2023. I'm Lynn Barco with the Minnesota Alliance for Ethical Healthcare. Happy to be here with you today. We've got a great presentation on the docket here. And before we get into that, I want to say a little bit about the Alliance. We are a coalition of about 75 different organizations, healthcare providers, disability rights groups, veterans groups, mental health organizations, faith-based organizations, and many others working on compassionate alternatives to the legalization of assisted suicide. And we started this webinar series to show really the diversity of our coalition and all of the different pieces of that that go into ensuring that we have real healthcare here in Minnesota and that we don't legalize assisted suicide. So today I want to make a pitch real quick at the beginning, if we have any new folks joining our webinar today, to go to ethicalcaremn.org/join. And we're going to have a slide up here, I think. There it is. And you can easily join the organization. There's no cost. And we welcome organizations, individuals, across the spectrum. We are a nonpartisan organization. And we welcome many, many different types of organizations to join in our work to support real healthcare here in Minnesota. So I want to get on today to our presenter. Our presenter is Jesse Bethke Gomez. He is the executive director of the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. MCIL is committed to empowering members of the disability community on a pathway to overcoming barriers and to discover access, choices, and the possibilities to realize their goals and aspirations. Jesse served as vice president of university and planning and advancement at Metro State University. He was also president of CLUES for 16 years, which grew to be a nationally recognized agency for its work in responsive healthcare, including behavioral health and newcomer communities. I also want to take a moment to talk a little bit more about MCIL. They're really a critical partner for us here in the disability community, and Jesse's going to talk a lot about them today, but I wanted to give a little bit of more description for our audience members today. It was founded 41 years ago, and MCIL retains a workforce of nearly 230 employees and personal care assistants. Each year, MCIL reaches more than 5,500 people with direct services, an additional 29,000 people who receive information and referrals along with system navigation advice as an operations site for call centers serving people with disabilities throughout Minnesota. So this community serving people with disabilities is so critical. It's so critical to our work to ensure real healthcare in Minnesota. And as many of you know on the call, we really had an important election this past November. And just wanted to emphasize that given the new significantly legislative landscape and one party control of state government, there really is urgency to reinvest in our advocacy efforts to ensure that physician assisted suicide is not legalized in Minnesota. Proponents of physician assisted suicide will be working proactively for legalization in this session. So the Alliance is inviting you and other partners to really advocate for compassionate alternatives to that really harmful legislation. So we work on palliative and hospice care legislation. We work on the workforce shortage issue. We work on mental health issues. And we also do a lot of work on behalf of people with disabilities, such as PCA rate reform and other issues. So with that intro, I see Jesse nodding his head. I want to introduce Jesse Bethke Gomez and turn it over to him for his presentation. We're also going to have questions at the end, so feel free to please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen, and you can enter questions. Please put them in early, and we'll make sure we get them into the queue. And probably at about 12:25 or so, we'll start the Q&A, and we will wrap up by 12:45. So we try to make these brief, but really informative and substantive, so everyone on the call can take action and support real healthcare here in Minnesota. With that, Jesse, I hand it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn. And I am very proud to be here with you. You know, when you think about the Minnesota Alliance for Ethical Healthcare, this is really important. I'm happy to launch your 2023 year And our webinar today is on strengthening the care for people with disabilities and supporting compassionate alternatives to the legalization of physician-assisted suicide. Lynn, we applaud your work. We believe that it's important work, and we're grateful to you and the Alliance for the great work that you're doing to elevate the sense of the dignity of humanity. If you will all allow me, I am going to screen share. And my presentation today, I have learned over the years that when you say things and people can read things, somehow communication works a little bit better. We're going to keep our time to 12:25. You'll hear me say that in a presentation. I want to share with you really four major areas that comprise this document, the National Declaration for Strengthening Direct Care Services and Benefits for People with Disabilities and Older Adults. I'm going to talk a little bit about a preamble, actually read some of it, and then talk about, share with you, emerging innovations to help solve the direct care crisis that have scalability throughout the United States. I'm going to present to you a little bit in the weeds, a item called electronic visit verification. I'll explain that to you in a moment. And then lastly, talk about there are what are called asset limitations for people with disabilities and older adults in order to reach certain types of federal benefits, as well as certain types of state benefits. MCIL, with our mission, removing barriers, promoting choices, we assist all people with disabilities, those with apparent and non-apparent disabilities. As you know, people receive benefits. Not everyone receives benefits, but all we assist with advancing what we call independent living. We believe that's very, very important. Let me take you then through, I'm going to move this slowly so everybody's with me. This is the document. We've offered to make this available to you through the Alliance has a site, and Lynn can share with you more. But I'm going to go through this a little bit. At MCIL, our agency has played a significant role during the last 3 years of the pandemic. And it is through that journey of assisting people, as well as assisting with testing and making certain people have accessible testing and accessible vaccinations, that it's a time for us to step back and think about where we're at as a nation. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to read this to you, and then my comments will very quickly go through others, and we'll be at 12:25 before you know it. Here we go. As we go forward through the 2020s and the 246th year of this American experiment, and as the oldest democracy in the world, it is in times as today that our generation of Americans is experiencing the continued presence of COVID in society and its impact upon society. Our national journey through these times have experienced great loss and toil, yet through adversity, we're discovering a renewed awareness of the fundamental principles of democracy, mainly that it is self-evident that human dignity is equally endowed amongst all humanity and every person throughout the world. It was only a few short years ago with the signing of the American with Disabilities Act, July 26, 1990, by Honorable President George Bush, that American society reached a new level of awareness about the principles of democracy, of human dignity. His words ring as a clarion bell for all time, in which he stated, "Our success with this act proves that we are keeping faith with the spirit of our courageous forefathers who wrote in the Declaration of Independence," quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights." These words have been our guide for more than two centuries as we have labored to form a more perfect union. But tragically, for too many Americans, the blessings of liberty have been limited or even denied. The Civil Rights Act of 64 took a bold step forward, righting that wrong. But the stark fact remained that people with disabilities were still victims of segregation and discrimination, and this was intolerable. Today's legislation brings us closer to that day when no Americans will ever again be deprived of the basic guarantee of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thusly, in the light of these defining moments of the rule of law that sets forth a threshold on human dignity, we are today compelled, just as previous generations of Americans, to work to bend the arc of history at a time when we are evidencing a crisis for people with disabilities with apparent and non-apparent disabilities and for older adults. The standards we have served us in the past fail to the crisis of direct care worker shortages, of new technologies that challenge civil rights, fundamental rights, and human dignity itself, and of laws frozen in time that result in people living in the shadows of human despair with 40-year asset limitations and no cost of living increase that have robbed people of their basic guarantee of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Therefore, I'm happy to present to you, as this document presents, we are resolved in this era to set forth a national declaration on these principles of democracy, of human dignity, and of certain inalienable rights, to solve the crisis of today by strengthening direct care services and benefits for people with disabilities and older adults, whereby solutions create progress, momentum, and the arc that meets the needs of all who rely upon direct services and care well into the future. Let me move quickly into, I'm going to share with you that this document talks about three areas. I won't read from the script, but I want to share with you that I was one of the technical writers for Minnesota's direct care recommendations that were approved by the Minnesota Olmsted Cabinet in March of 2018. This document looked at the time we had about 7,000 PCA job openings serving tens of thousands of people with disabilities and older adults. By today's standards, we know recently from a Star Tribune report that in Minnesota alone, there are today over 9,000 PCA job openings that are unfilled. And that's distressing that though we have begun the work, that we find ourselves in the current situation that we do. I want to share with you that the work of MCIL, thanks to Bush Foundation Community Innovation, we started to look at what could MCIL do to help advance the sector. Today, we are working on a college credit curriculum leading to the credential in the certificate program of, quote, a certified PCA. And a certified PCA, similar to a certified nursing assistant, is designed from the standpoint of assisting people at home, assisting people in the basis of independent living, and to look at how we can bring forth this emerging opportunity. In our work during the last 4 years, we've discovered that we are among the first to actually bring this forward as a means. This would be a voluntary third tier for Minnesota, but this would be a secondary tier for most of the nation. Why is this important? Because this helps people with the skills, but it also was a certificate. It leads to the second item that I want to share with you. And that is what is called a PCA rate framework. We're grateful to an ally group, a much broader group, that worked assiduously with the state of Minnesota on what's called a PCA rate framework. I know I'm a little bit into the weeds, but bear with me. What a PCA rate framework has, and this was approved the 2021 legislative session, is that a PCA rate framework has, by law, what are called component values. Competitive workforce factors, which means if we have a certified PCA, which we haven't brought forth yet, but when we do, we believe that having a certified PCA, those component values and these competitive workforce factors then have to say, to look at the competitive compensation for similar positions like a certified nursing assistant in the medical system. We believe there is a differential there that makes a difference, that now we can link pursuit of an education that has a way that is valued with other similar positions in the workforce. So these workforce factors potentially lead to an increase or a differential in compensation that really is a market change in the 40 years of a PCA program. Let me share with you the third area that MCIL is working on. I'm so proud to say, as of January 17th, 2023, MCIL has commenced what we call a pre-launch phase for the first ever PCA direct support professional, or we would say the college service course in the state of Minnesota. We're grateful to the Margaret A. Cargill Philanthropy and the St. Paul Foundation for this opportunity to bring forth a pilot in which we are seeking to recruit 50 college students who serve upwards of 30 weeks and become and serve as a personal care assistant for people who are assessed at 10 or more hours of PCA assistance per day. So that in this pilot, we're looking at how do we find satisfaction? How do we look at impacting healthcare costs? And also, how do we look at scalability? How do you take this kind of effort then that is not only throughout the state of Minnesota, but that can begin to bring this forward throughout the nation as well? We're at 12:17. We're doing good on time. I want to talk a little bit with you about some other areas too. And this is called electronic visit verification. Let me share with you that electronic visit verification was part of the H.R. 34, the 21st Century CARES Act. It was actually section 12006. And electronic visit verification basically called forward that there would be electronic visit verification. And in essence, what electronic visit verification would do would create, in essence, a timesheet on a cell phone that a person would have that a PCA would sign in the person's home. There are six features to this, and yet one of the areas that we have learned is that originally in the Act, there were not the distinction of these six areas. This is later came forth with the Social Security Act. But one of the areas of great concern about this is what is called the global positioning system, that the electronic visit verification, some of the EVVs have a government-controlled GPS. That really, in essence, is a concern for people with disabilities and older adults. Not all people, but this is a concern that that we noted. And in this act, it's an amazing act, the 21st Century Cures Act, that really looks at how do you bring forth technology that's really the 21st century, that can bring the healthcare system in the United States to a much higher level. Yet this act, with only one sentence, really varies from so many of the technologies that were identified, that these really phenomenally well-written protocols, that how these technologies would be introduced. Electronic visit verification was one sentence. And so when you step back and say, if this act was not consistent in so many of the other technologies having the kind of checks and balances, and EVV being mandated to be used by people with disabilities and older adults, if it's not consistent, then how can it be fair? CMS has said that electronic visit verification can be an option right here in this document, that CMS says that there's no requirement to use global positioning services in the electronic visit verification by the states. Most states do not know that. I've had people, you know, ask me, why are you making this a big deal? You know, quote, Minnesota can't do anything about it. Well, that's not true. CMS has said that each state has the right to decide whether or not to choose GPS. But the fundamental question here is this: why is there a government-controlled GPS in the first place? Who bothered to check whether or not this would align with civil rights and, quite frankly, the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution against government infringement? These are serious concerns. I do not make light of this. So these are the areas that we're concerned about when laws are done onto people with very little ability for people to have a say. How are we to hold ourselves to the great aspirations, as Honorable President George Bush stated in the commencement of ADA, and to find ourselves in the year 2023 with an electronic visit verification that is a concern with regard to the civil rights, the Ninth Amendment right, specifically to whether or not a GPS is allowed or provided. That's a concern. Let me move lastly, it's 12:21, we're on tracking on time. And let me move lastly is that I want to say that when the pandemic hit and in our services that we provided, we saw clients limiting our meetings with people through telephones in 15 minutes. And we didn't understand why, because people on many waivers programs can't afford Wi-Fi and unlimited minutes. We started to look into this. I looked into this and I discovered that for many certain federal benefits, that the asset limitation that a person has to have in place, whether a person with disabilities or older adults, such as like for elderly waiver programs, is $2,000 asset limit for an individual or $3,000 for a couple. That law was promulgated in 1983, exactly 40 years ago. And that $2,000 asset limit is the exact same dollar asset limit today as it was in 1983. Now, there have been a lot of presidents of the United States. There have been a lot of federally elected officials from 1983 to today. And the question really is why has that asset limitation not changed? And thusly, this is why I want to start, why I want to end this presentation where I started, and that is ever more so that the two fundamental principles of democracy, number one, the certain inalienable rights, and number two, it is self-evident that human dignity is equally endowed amongst all humanity. That means every person in the world throughout all time. That these are the prisms, these are the standards, these are the pillars by which we have to ask ourselves as a democracy, as a civil society, our generations of who we are. In my belief, that the most ignoble value for us and our generation, and dare I say for the entirety of all civilization is this, is to advance the ability of people to care for one another. From this standpoint, is it just, is it right that there should be these technologies mandated with a government-controlled GPS? Is it within the purview of who we are that we should have fixed assets of $2,000? When will they change them? Do we change them, if not year 40? Will we change them at year 50? Or do we wait till year 100 because it's a nice round number? The point is this, is that the pandemic brought out that it is critically important that we recognize the humanity in one another. It's critically important that as a democracy, that we think about who we are and how do we assure that people who need benefits have access to them and that those benefits and those services meet the standard of assisting to advance the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but that they also maintain human dignity. Can a person maintain human dignity with an asset limitation and today's high inflation environment of $2,000? This is why this is a national agenda. And it really is a national agenda to awaken ourselves for who we are, so that by recognizing the goodness, the value, that great sense of who we have always been as a nation, that we bend the arc of history in a way that makes a difference in advancing and passing the baton to the next generation for the greater good and the common good for all of us of who we are.
Jesse, thank you so much for that remarkable presentation. I want to remind everybody that you can place your questions in the Q&A. We already have some coming our way. I just wanted to say a couple comments as by way of thoughts here that just as you were finishing up, it reminded me that Minnesota really is a pioneer in healthcare and supporting those who are vulnerable with our history with the Mayo Clinic, with the University of Minnesota. We've been a leader in healthcare, and it's really heartening to see that MCIL is taking the lead with strengthening care for people with disabilities. It also really reminded me too that I think we can, for our first question, we really can narrow in on this workforce development issue, which you so eloquently outlined. I think in particular, just to give it some context from where we sit at the Alliance, we know that the number one reason that people choose assisted suicide is that they have a fear of being a burden to others. And it's not because of pain that is suffering or unbearable. And so we know that we really have a social issue here at hand, not necessarily a medical issue. And so we have this in our country, I think, this idea of a throwaway culture that's when someone gets older or someone has a vulnerability or has a disease that they're sort of less value. And again, I thought you did a really good job of outlining how we can close that gap. But in particular, that workforce shortage is a real issue because if we're not going to have the workforce in place, whether it's in the area you work or in long-term care where we have many of our partners work, how are we going to be able to bridge that gap? So maybe talk a little bit more about some solutions that you see. And maybe I know it's the PCA rate reform issue, which the Alliance helped work on in 2021. Yes, absolutely. And I know there are other areas too. So maybe unpack that workforce development issue a little bit and let people see the complexity of it, but also how we can kind of get a hand on it.
Great. I'm happy to do so. Part of the report that we prepared, I'm going to speak to that is this. Up until the year 2020, the number of net new workers, I'll just deal with Minnesota rather than national, give you an example. Net number of new workers from age 16 to 65 to Minnesota on an annual basis was approximately 39,500 people. We had seen projections that said by the year 2030 that the net number of new people to the workforce between 16 and 65 would be somewhere in the area of 5,000 to 7,000 people. Let me give you an example of why we believe that trend line is the case, and I'll make a comment about the pandemic. Today in Minnesota, there are about a million people age 65 and over. If you took the last four decades of people over age 65 and combined them, that number would be less than the number today. We know by projections within Minnesota and nationally that that number almost doubles by the year 2030. And here's what we think has happened with the pandemic, that the pandemic, we have seen, we believe, that there has been an acceleration of workers exiting the workforce, notably older workers. With a 1.5% unemployment rate, I've recently been in discussions at the state level to look at, okay, how do we look at a study that look at essential occupational positions within Department of Human Service, which is called the Home and Community-Based Healthcare, Home and Community-Based Services, and Department of Health, nursing and nursing-related positions, and then in education for teachers and substitute teachers. People do not know that today, as an example, substitute teachers have an 85% unfilled rate. So what we need to start thinking about is let's look at the study between the growth of those positions, and there are growth in these positions. Number two, let's look at the demographic shifts of where we see that there will be gaps in those essential occupational capabilities. And then working with Minnesota State, working with University of Minnesota, working with the private colleges and universities, you know, how do we bring forth a plan such as a very articulate and very strategic student loan forgiveness program? How do we bring forth opportunities like what we're working on, a PCA College Service Corps opportunity? How do we bring the kind of education linked with a PCA rate that elevates the prosperity for people through the power of education? These are doable. We have the tools, we've got the means. The question is, do we have the will to get out ahead of this? And I believe that if there's any state that can do that, I join you in saying Minnesota is a leader in so many ways, and now's not the time to acquiesce that leadership as well. Thank you for the question. I'm mute.
That darn mute button, right? After all these years of Zoom calls. So we have another question along that same line of workforce shortage. And this is specifically from one of our members who talks about how is it possible how does a certified certificate get more direct care staff? PCAs and direct care staff need higher hourly rates of pay and healthcare benefits. She says, my son requires 24/7, 365 day around the clock care. He can never be left alone. And she says, we need immediate and real help, and been talking about the staffing catastrophe for years. So maybe get down to a level of granularity, maybe in terms of how to address this very specific concern.
Well, yes. First and foremost, this is why the PCA rate framework that currently looks at for the current PCAs, the competitive workforce factors of PCAs to compare to other places in the workforce. We think that that has a very positive effect. Wages need to go up. PCA rates need to go up. These kind of efforts, they do studies to examine how those rates and compensations go. So we are searing, and I am hearing of significant conversations at the state level about PCA rates and wages that will be more competitive. Number one, I agree, especially for people who are assessed at 10 or more hours of assistance. We believe that we need to do everything we can to bring PCAs to make certain that we're filling those job gaps for people who often have complex health conditions. A certified PCA combined with the PCA rate framework, we believe can have a differential, an increase in wage. We need to work in a concerted way as a sector for this very ennobled opportunity to people who serve as PCAs. For many people that I know, they really love that area of service. The opportunity for us is to linkage ways that can increase those wages, that can compete with other opportunities that people have to go elsewhere. And I believe that by helping to build the educational framework only as a third volunteer tier, and also the rate framework that lifts all of the wages and reimbursement rates for the entirety of the PCA area, we can make a difference. Very granular, very specific, and work that we've been in support of as well. The crisis is real, and I hear the anguish in the questioner, and I empathize with the anguish of all people that are struggling right now. It's why it's what propels me to do what I do, to make a difference right now. It's a great question.
Continuing along that line of healthcare and that spectrum of care, can you talk a little bit about where you see the problem of ableism in healthcare, and specifically how we can narrow that healthcare disparities, especially among people of color? For example, we know, again, during the pandemic, that a lot of those gaps became enlarged and widened. We also know from a lot of the work we do, for example, in the palliative and healthcare area, that people with disabilities and people of color use those services at lower rates and access them at lower rates. And the evidence is really out there that if you legalize assisted suicide, you're really going to see that gap widen. And in particular, we are really troubled by the case of Michael Hixon. You might have heard of him. He was an African-American gentleman from Texas. He was a quadriplegic. He got COVID, and the decision was made by his hospital to end care against the wishes of his family. And he subsequently passed away in the hospital. And so sometimes we try to think that ableism doesn't exist in healthcare, that some of these issues I talked about don't really exist, but we know they're there. And we want to reach out to vulnerable communities who are at risk. And so maybe talk about that broad issue as it relates to your work and where you see maybe some abilities or some opportunities to close that gap.
It's a great question. I want to mention to your audience that I wrote the lead article for Minnesota Physicians Publishing Company, their September 2022 issue. It is called Perfect Occupancy, Why Everybody Needs Coordinated Care. Look, let me explain something that I've been talking about over and over statewide and nationally. Our healthcare platform includes hospitals and clinics on one end, and home and community-based and facilities on the other end. Too often what I have seen are silos within that area. What I am arguing and writing about and helping to promote is that we think about the coordination of that care, not by the experts for the experts, but I want to introduce this term for your audience. And that is, we take a person-centered approach, a patient-centered approach, and say that it's an obligation for all providers to work, use a term, interoperably. I was on the committee for the state of Minnesota that introduced and said, Minnesota needs to have an electronic medical record. What I wish we would have elevated, that it should be standardized, and it should be interoperable, and it should be coordinated. So much of the issues that we find are that a lack of coordination, a lack of sense of how people work together. It's painful for me to hear about this person's journey. They are ethical considerations that need to be in place. But if a hospital, I'm not speaking about this in particular, but when a hospital sees themselves a part of the broader good. When I used to be the president of Comunidades Latinas Unidas en Servicio for 17 years as a behavioral health organization with licensed mental health and chemical health care, we helped to look at how we brought our services to coordinate with inpatient. In the hospitals, at first, we're like, gee, how do we do that? You know, we have every metric for when people come in and leave. We need to say is we need to be porous. We need to be interoperable. We need to coordinate our care. We have among the best medical capabilities in the entire world. The opportunity for us is to innovate, to work within that innovation. I'm not going to say to work smarter, but to value people as a person-centered framework that all services need to work in tandem to better assist the individual. I could go on, but I would refer you to that article. I am also in a roundtable article that goes very specific, very granular on things like assessments that happen for people with disabilities or older adults. Those are determinations that are made for their long-term service and supports. And incredibly, the primary physician is not part of that. We have to figure out how do we, again, bring this coordinated care that celebrates the individual in a way that the person is in the driver's seat for their life and for the care and for their own future. It's a great question. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jesse. We have a final question here that kind of comes back to some specific issues related to DHS here in Minnesota and the waiver system. And I know you're an expert on this, so I think this would be a great question. So the question basically is, the Minnesota Department of Human Services Disability Division, it focuses millions of dollars that are allocated for Minnesota or MnChoices 2.0 and the waiver program. This person says, can we reimagine both, according to which DHS Disability Division are not designed to address these catastrophic home caring crises? In other words, the system that's currently in place isn't really getting at the kind of the nerve of this home care staffing crisis, which from our perspective is really a concern, because we know that people do better typically when they're at home. And if they can stay at home in a care setting that is appropriate, that's something that generally works well. So maybe take that apart a little bit for us and show us maybe a way forward with that.
Well, I know that today Senate File 7 that was authored by Senator John Hoffman, who is the chair of the Human Services Committee, and he is the chair of the Health and Human Services, I believe it's called Finance Committee. He's introduced a massive upgrade to meet the crisis needs. We find ourselves in a third year of a pandemic. I think we have to also realize, it's not excuse, context. We are in a generational mode, not equal to, but separate from the 1930s depression, not equal, separate from the 1917 pandemic where millions of people also lost their lives. Department of Human Services, where they can build upon, is that most people do not know, is that there are 87 lead agencies. And lead agencies, what that means is there are 87 counties. We actually have the kind of framework and capability that is extraordinary for Minnesota, because we have a broader way that we can harness the best of who we are to really address, we're addressing structural changes, we're addressing demographic shifts. And really the opportunity is, how do we work with the Department of Human Services? I can share with you that the part of the Disability Services Division that I've been working with in the workforce innovations area, they were the folks that worked with DEED to bring forth their recommendations. There are innovations that that certain folks in that department are leading that we continually support, we continue a part of. And I want to say that efforts like what you heard me say were born out of those great invitations that the Department of Human Services has said, we need to go farther. I believe Senate File 7 elevates immeasurably. The question for us, though, at the state level and for the citizenry, is not the question of how much is this going to cost. The real question is, what is our commitment to one another to fully fund what we need as a state? And we really need to make certain that our entire citizen realize that when we fully fund these capabilities, that we can address the criticality of issues that often these programs have been underfunded for a very long period of time. So my hope is that we can make a difference with Senate File 7, that we can make a difference with the kind of innovations. And I'm really confident that working together, I am really honored to say that working with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, working with the PCA agency communities, PCAs themselves, and especially with people with disabilities and older adults, that we can work together in a way that can bring the best of what we can, because the crisis is real. And how do we build upon what we know works, and at the same time, where can we innovate? And at the same time, we must fund where we must. This is not an issue of cost. It is an issue of our will. It's an issue of our values as a society. And it really is up to our generation to make certain that we make the kind of changes that are structural, so that we never again have the kind of crisis that we're facing, that I see every day. It's a great question, and I applaud the questioner for that as well.
Thank you so much, Jesse. I think your comments there at the end really underscore how all of us need to stay involved in this issue wherever we are at. If you are the parent or a relative or family member of someone with a disability, or if you have a disability yourself, or you're a member of an organization that supports people with disabilities, really need to stay involved. One way to do that is through the Minnesota Alliance for Ethical Healthcare. At our Take Action tab, we have our legislative agenda and our legislative actions there that you can really address these exact things that Jesse is talking about today. And this legislative session, like we said at the very beginning, has just started. It's going to go till May. We are in the first year of the biennium, which is a two-year period. And so there's going to be a lot of different issues that are going to be introduced and discussed. We know there's already about 2,500 bills that have been introduced, and many of them relate to exactly what we're talking about today. So the Minnesota Alliance for Ethical Healthcare and our partners like MCIL will be at the forefront of that discussion at the Capitol, and making sure your voice is heard. But we need your voice. We need everyone to be at the table, to be advocating, and to be involved. So with that, I want to thank Jesse Bethke Gomez for that really instructive, remarkable presentation. And we look forward to seeing you all at our next webinar. And please stay in touch with us at our latest updates by going to our website, ethicalcaremn.org. Thank you so much.